Vice Chair of List Training.
Ms. Hutchinson, did Rudy Giuliani ever suggest he was interested in receiving a presidential pardon related to January 6th?
He did.
Ms. Hutchinson, did White House Chief of Staff Meadows ever indicate that he was interested in receiving a presidential pardon related to January 6th?
Ms. Meadows did seek that pardon, yes, ma'am.
In her closing statement Tuesday, House January 6th Committee Vice Chair List Cheney suggested witnesses from allies have been intimidating committee witnesses.
Our nation is preserved by those who abide by their oaths to our Constitution. Our nation is preserved by those who know the fundamental difference between right and wrong. And I want all Americans to know that what Ms. Hutchinson has done today is not easy. The easy course is to hide from the spotlight, to refuse to come forward, to attempt to downplay or deny what happened. That brings me to a different topic. While our committee has seen many witnesses, including many Republicans, testify fully and forthrightly, this has not been true of every witness. And we have received evidence of one particular practice that raises significant concern. Our committee commonly asks witnesses connected to Mr. Trump's administration or campaign whether they've been contacted by any of their former colleagues or anyone else who attempted to influence or impact their testimony. Without identifying any of the individuals involved, let me show you a couple of samples of answers we received to this question. First, here is how one witness described phone calls from people interested in that witness's testimony. Quote, what they said to me is, as long as I continue to be a team player, they know I'm on the right team. I'm doing the right thing. I'm protecting who I need to protect. You know I'll continue to stay in good graces in Trump world. And they have reminded me a couple of times that Trump does read transcripts. And just keep that in mind as I proceed in my interviews with the committee. Here's another sample in a different context. This is a call received by one of our witnesses. Quote, the person let me know you have your deposition tomorrow. He wants me to let you know he's thinking about you. He knows you're loyal and you're going to do the right thing when you go in your deposition. I think most Americans know that attempting to influence witnesses to testify untruthfully presents very serious concerns.
And we end with Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor General Mike Flynn, who supported Trump's efforts to overturn the election. During Tuesday's hearing, the House committee aired excerpts of video deposition with Flynn. He repeatedly refused to answer questions from House Committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney.
Do you believe the violence on January 6th was justified morally? Do you believe the violence on January 6th was justified legally?
General Flynn, do you believe in the peaceful transition of power in the United States of America?
The fifth, so said President Trump's former National Security Advisor General Mike Flynn in videotaped testimony. He was answering the questions of Committee Vice Chair Congressmember Liz Cheney. If you want to see the full surprise hearing yesterday that lasted about two hours with Cassidy Hutchinson, various deposition testimony, like Mike Flynn, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
USDA Organic Products Standards, WRCT Pittsburgh. We'd like to inform you that all RTJs are genetically modified for year guys pass the meat.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
To a wayward word, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. When you answer the phone, do you have a favorite word or phrase that's a little bit out of the ordinary, or maybe you know somebody who does that? We asked readers of our email newsletter that question, and they had some surprising responses. We heard from Matt on Nantucket Island, Massachusetts, who told us that when he picks up the phone, he says front desk. he says he does that in an attempt to stop the caller's brain, if only for a nanosecond, and it often works. We heard from Ann Lynn in Ithaca, New York, who wrote that her grandfather, who was born in the late 1800s and lived in Ontario, Canada, used to pick up the phone and say, commands.
Just commands.
Yeah. And then from Marlene Dryden, this question brought back memories of her great Aunt Eula McQuaid of Salisbury, North Carolina. She says Miss Eula would hear her phone ring from a little alcove in the wall of her foyer, and she'd slowly walk over there, pick it up calmly, and holler,
All right.
That's fantastic.
Isn't that great? She has that beautiful, nearly tidewater accent and the smell of cornbread are the vivid memories I have of her. And I wonder if that's a vestige of when you had operators plugging in the cord.
Right. You didn't even check the line was okay before you began your conversation. We would love to hear more about how you answer the phone. What do you say? Is it funny? Is it old-fashioned? Is it something cool or weird? 877-929-9673. Email words at waywardradio.org. And the lines are open to talk about anything related to language. You can talk to us on Twitter, too, at W-A-Y-W-O-R-D. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, this is Marianne. I'm calling from Valdosta, Georgia.
Hi, Marianne.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah, what would you like to talk to us about?
Well, I want to know the proper way to pronounce the word spelled B-O-N-A-F-F-I-D-E-S. I'm not sure if the B-O-N is pronounced bone or bond. And I'm not sure if FIDES is pronounced FIDES or one syllable FIDES.
Oh boy. Marianne, where have you run across this expression spelled B-O-N-A-F-I-D-E-S?
I read every night before I go to sleep. And I ran across it in a book. And it's one of those words that I have a little trouble reading. But if I try to say it, it sticks in my throat because no way I tried to pronounce it sounded correct. And I looked it up and listened to several pronunciations, and I got even more confused because there seemed to be multiple so-called acceptable ways to pronounce this term. And I thought, I have to stand on this. When you take a stand on which way you're going to put the toilet paper on the toilet paper holder, either over or under, I had to find out the best way to pronounce it. So I'm prevailing upon you to solve this for me.
Oh boy. Well, the answer is over, right?
Over.
For the toilet paper?
Of course.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you.
And this term means something like authentic credentials, right? Isn't that the sense that you have when you're reading and you come across this expression?
Authentic credentials. Yes, exactly.
Okay. I tell you, Marianne, I have always pronounced it bona fides. But you know, there are some authorities who have sneered at that pronunciation, and they say it should be bona fides.
place. But anyway, bona fides
are usually the pronunciations heard in the United States.
It was borrowed intact
from Latin, spelled the same way, E-O-N-A, and then separate word, F-I-D-E-S.
And in Latin, you pronounce it
bona fides,
and that literally means good faith.
So the fides means faith, it's like our word fidelity.
And the bona
means good,
it's like our word bonus.
So bona fides in Latin,
somebody who's trying to show off that they've had a little Latin
may say bona fides.
But you know, that's pretentious. I mean, we're speaking English and not Latin.
And if we're going to be that strict
about pronouncing words from Latin, then we shouldn't be talking about quoting somebody verbatim,
because in Latin it's where bottom.
And we shouldn't be talking about things
ad infinitum,
because in Latin it would be ad infinitum.
And Marianne,
the other thing that complicates this is the fact that the fides in Latin, bona fides, is actually one of those rare Latin nouns that end in S,
but they're actually singular.
They're not many of those.
That
means that when this term was adopted whole into English in the 17th century, people might say something like, that person's bona fides is impeccable,
meaning their good faith and their sincerity is impeccable.
And it was only later that people started saying that person's bona fides or that person's bona fides are impeccable.
So
I come down on the side of just saying find a different word,
credentials,
good faith, sincerity, something like that.
Well, I like that recommendation. That simplifies my life tremendously. However, I am going to practice saying bona fide. So if I am forced to say it in a conversation, I will know with certainty the way I'm supposed to pronounce it. And I like the clean contemporary sound of bona fides instead of the Latin, which, as you say, sounds a little pretentious.
Exactly.
So bona fides or bona fides.
Or, as you said earlier, don't avoid using it and say something like faith or credibility or credentials or authenticity.
Right.
I like that.
Bye, Mary. Take care.
Bye, Mary.
Thank you. 877-999-9673. Chat on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Remember our conversation about pigeon pairs.
Those aren't birds.
They're people.
Right. That's when family has a boy and a girl. And no more, no less.
Right.
That conversation
prompted a response from Jesse Ravage, who lives in Cooperstown, New York.
And she writes,
My mother was told when my brother was born that now she had a millionaire's family.
She figured
it was because there would be no handing down of clothes from Jesse to her brother.
You know, it was really expensive to have two kids like that.
But it sounds like it's more like an ideal.
I found lots of instances of the term million dollar family,
which is also one boy and one girl,
or some people refer to $2 million families, which are two boys and two girls.
No. and so the idea is just like the pigeon pair, sometimes called royal pair, or the king's pair. The idea that this is just what you would really want to find are a great family.
Right. One to marry off, and one to take over. Right.
You can pick which one is which.
Yes, supposedly the ideal. But of course, families come in all different shapes and sizes.
Yes, they do. And tell us about your family and the language you use. You can tell us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hello, we have a way with words.
Hi, this is Nathan from San Antonio.
Hey, Nathan, welcome.
So I have a question for you all about a word that I heard all the time growing up, and the word is crisp. And I thought I'd tell you a little bit about it when I hear it. So I grew up in Chicago, and my parents would often take us on a road trip down to Florida to go to like Disney World or something like that. And we get up really early in the morning to leave at about 4 a.m. So I really do really tired and cranky, and they would use the word crisp to basically mean that, for example, if I was bothering my sister, my parents might say, Nathan, leave her alone, she's really crisp. Or if I snipped at my parents, I would say, oh, I'm sorry, I was just being friends. And I've used this word many times since then, and no one knows what I'm talking about. And when I asked my parents about it, they heard it growing up. Like, all my friends in Chicago haven't heard of it, and I've tried to look it up, and I just don't know where it's coming from, or if it's the real thing, or just a family thing.
And Nathan, you're spelling it C-R-I-S-P?
That's right, Chris.
Okay, yeah. I think we can help you with this. So just to recap here, it's early in the morning. Everyone's gotten up at 4 a.m., and you and your sister are... Just not morning people. You are still tired, cranky, and just not with it.
Right. And my brother.
So this is three little monsters that your parents are going to keep together, and you're all crisp.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the parents are probably crisp, too. They've got to suffer through their parenthood. Probably help you with this. I think this is probably a form of a crisp adjective that I know that is in Green's Dictionary of Slang. Jonathan Green has put this together, and he takes this back to the late 70s, and the definition that he has is... Suffering from an excess of drugs, drink, fast living, and stress. Obviously, that doesn't fully apply to three children on the way to Disney World. But I think the suffering from an excess and the stress part, too, because we're talking about somebody that is burned out. And that's what crisp is. It's literally a synonym for other slang expressions like fried, baked, or burned out, where you are just exhausted. Nothing left in the tank. There's no energy to spare.
Cool. Yeah, that absolutely sounds about right. Is there any like regional thing to it? Like you know what I mean? Or some of the earliest uses
come up from slang collected on college campuses. So it's not regional, but it might be what's called age graded, where it started with young people. And I don't know how old your parents are, but if they were in college in, say, the mid to late 70s, that's where they learned it.
Yeah, that totally checks out. Wow. Well, that's absolutely. I can't wait to tell my folks. Yeah, that they just make it up.
Not just your family. Well, Nathan, thanks for calling. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Grant. Y'all are great. I love the show. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, of course. Take care.
Bye-bye.
877-929-9773. In the parts of the southern United States, if you really like the food you're eating, you can say so with your feet. Specifically, you say something like, I could eat this with my toe in the fire. Or I could eat this with one foot in the milk bucket.
Oh, how about that? I don't think I knew that.
Suggesting that the food is so delicious that you can ignore the circumstances.
You could also do it with your feet by walking up to the counter and putting in another order.
Right.
I have some more of that right at this place.
That's right. Burn out your calories in your chair and in the counter.
Get us at wordsatwaywardradio.org.
More about what you say and why you say it. Stick around for more of Away with Words. You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett, and we're joined by this guy. It's John Chinesky. Haven't seen you in a whole week, and you're looking very different, John. John Chinesky, our quiz guy.
Thank you, I did shave. I had a beard. I don't know how you picked that up. In any case, let's move on to this puzzle here, this quiz I have for you. You know, very often creativity is born out of love. For example, many performers, actors, singers, and works of fiction, TV shows, movies, have such a dedicated fan base that the group adopts a unique name to identify them to each other and the outside world. Now, one of the most famous, of course, is Trekkies, to refer to fans of the Star Trek TV and movie franchise. And perhaps you know that fans of the singer Justin Bieber are called...
believers.
Right, exactly. So we're going to take a trip through some hardcore fandoms. Let's see if you can answer these questions about the fans of different performers or things. Okay?
Yeah.
Good. Now, you might know that the fans of Taylor Swift use what name? It sounds as if they might be fans of funny adverbs, Tom said vocally.
Swifties,
yes, exactly. They are Swifties. These two are similar and simple. He writes the songs like Coca Cabana and Could It Be Magic, but his followers just change the first letter of his last name and pluralize it to get their fandom. What are they?
Menelos?
Right, they change the first letter
to get...
Fanalos.
Fanalos, yes.
Plural of man.
Menelos. No, Fanalos. Yeah.
Actors too have fandoms.
Actor Chris Pine has a devoted following. It may be a simply constructed fandom name, but I like how it reminds me of delicious seeds used to make pesto.
Pine nuts.
Yes. Pretty simple.
Similarly, what longtime talk show host followers call themselves?
Coconuts.
What's his face? Red hair, tall Irish. Conan O'Brien fans.
Conan O'Brien, that's right. Of course, since fans of Jimmy Buffett are parrotheads, and fans of the Grateful Dead are deadheads, if you make a fist, you might figure out the fandom name for fans of the band Five Finger Death Punch.
Fist heads? Punch heads?
No, when you make a fist, what do you highlight on your hand?
You make a fist, you highlight knuckleheads.
Yes, for five-finger death punch. I like that one. Finally, he does things differently, and funnily, so not surprisingly, comedians' fandom call themselves, or likely dubbed by the man himself, close personal friends of Al.
Weirdos?
No. That's the actual name of the fandom, close personal friends of Al. I think you know the person. Who is it?
That's Weird Al Yankovic.
It is Weird Al Yankovic. Yeah, it's one of my favorite fandom names. Close personal friends of Al.
So perfect.
Well, listen, I'm a fan of you two guys, and I think you did a great job in that episode. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
We'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you then.
The show does puzzles. We'd like to talk to you about the puzzles you have over language. What's the question you've been asking yourself, and where did that come from? Why does it mean that? What's the real answer? Well, we'd like to sort it out. 877-929-9673.
Words. Hello, we have a way with words.
Do you have any French heritage, or just you just found it amusing, so you decided to use it?
I took French in college, and that's where I got this book. And as I traveled to France and things,
I saw a lot of really interesting conversations going on in the subways and stuff.
But those would teach your grandchildren.
They would be, you know, two people would be linking to each other across the tracks and that kind of thing.
But this book is really helpful. You have to be a little bit careful because there's something that, if you're not part of the culture, you might not get.
Context is everything.
So be careful.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us and your story of meeting your grandkids and your father with this book. Call it, right?
Thank you.
Share your stories and experiences about language, 877-929-9673, or send them to us in email. The address is words@wadiaradio.org. We talked not long ago about the word ORT, meaning small bite of food that's left on dinner plate. And some people learn that word when they're reading Virginia Woolf or D.H. Lawrence. And other people pick it up when they're doing crosswords because it's such a handy word. But apparently a lot of people learn this word at summer camp. We heard from Linda Hahn of New York City, who wrote to say that the first time she heard the word ORT was when she chaperoned her daughter's sixth grade class to a sleepaway camp in the Poconos. And at the end of the camper's first meal there, the camp counselors pointed out some buckets in the dining hall. And they called these the ORT buckets. And they told the kids to scrape all the excess food off their plates into those buckets and then go back to their seats. Those scraps of food almost filled onto the buckets, and that's when the counselors told them that the ORT buckets should remind them to be mindful of food waste, and they challenged the kids to make sure that by the end of the week, those ORT buckets were empty. And sure enough, it worked. And Linda says, I wonder if these camp people go to some kind of group meeting to figure out new strategies to engage preteens at these camps. Someone was like, hey, how about we focus on food waste this year? And some word nerd at the table says,
I know, call it the ORT report.
And Grant, apparently this was a thing because we heard from another listener about the Bailey ORT report at a camp in New England. So I'm figuring that maybe a lot of English majors were working some jobs up there in the mountains.
And summer camps have been a thing for a very long time. So they've had an incredible amount of experience in putting together all these different opportunities to teach more about hikes and canoeing. By the way, I was telling my son about our conversation about orcs, and he said, oh, isn't that a baby orc?
Yeah, when they're just born, they're called ortlets.
Call us up, 877-929-9773.
Welcome to Away with Words.
Hi, this is Stephen from East New York.
Hey, Stephen.
I was inquiring about the word Dutchman. I'm a furniture maker. And I've come across it when I was working in New England. And we're for a relatively high-end furniture. And essentially what it is is a patch. But my understanding of the duct is that it is a patch of a much higher level than just sort of a spackled over kind of thing. Where we would be shaping the edge of the table. And you would do your best to clear stock. But inevitably, as you profile down into something, you'd find like a little cat paw or a mineral streak or something like that, which had to make a Dutchman. You would square out the joint and let in a piece of solid stock that was cleaner or didn't have the defect in it. And that was called a Dutchman. And my limited googling on it has sort of led me to that it was the work of a lesser quality, and that's Not what I understand it to me, but I guess I sort of wondered from whence, etymology or the origin of it. Why a Dutchman?
Thank you for the backstory on how you use that, because that word really has gone through some changes since it first popped up in English at least 100 years ago. So you use Dutchman in woodworking. A mistake is if you're patching an imperfection perfectly so that people can't tell.
Right. I mean, grain color and everything else. I mean, certainly it has been used.
There's a lot more to say on this, because folklorists and researchers have looked into this. As a matter of fact, Archie Green was one researcher who wrote about this in the 1960s in the Journal American Speech. And he talked to woodworkers all over the country at the time about this. And the overall point that he makes about Dutchmen is that it's one of the very large set of slangy terms used in blue-collar physical labor professions that refer to ethnic or national origin, and they can be negative or positive or neutral, but they all reflect this integration of immigrants into the workplace and the friction that can generate. And so sometimes it comes out as humor, or sometimes dark humor, but it comes out in these little terms like Dutchmen. And so they're all these terms, and sometimes they're outside the workplace, so they represent these nations and ethnicities on the world stage, and they show up in these little ways. And in this case, Archie Green thinks it has to do with the huge number of German immigrants who came to the U.S. during the 1800s, many of them bringing this prized woodworking skill. And as you may know, the German Deutsch means German, was often termed as Dutch in English. And so people thought possibly the Dutchman just refers to this very careful way of fixing or replacing an imperfection, a bit of wood, and the very skilled way that a German would do it.
They were the highest caliber, and that's what they brought to it.
It's about solving your problems, finding a good outcome. Even in the face of a less than ideal situation, the Dutchman is about solving a problem. And what's interesting is the older uses of Dutchman were about just even fielders or space holders, not necessarily a perfect one, and not necessarily to fix a mistake. It might just be the wood's a little uneven, so you have to plane it some. Or that could be a Dutchman, or smooth out a hollow. And it was used in typesetting, masonry, metalwork, shipbuilding, theater, in order to make two sets match. They would use a Dutchman of canvas or cloth. All of these fields used the term Dutchman in a lot of different ways, and typesetting. They would take toothpicks and wedge the leg tight to get it exactly where they wanted, and that was a Dutchman.
Interesting to see what the trade is through the birth of it, but I suppose they might never know.
Well, I do believe that it was from shipbuilding. That's the earliest uses that we find.
Thank you, Mike, so much for sharing some of your own work with us. It sounds like a fascinating thing you do.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bring us your words and phrases from your work or from your hobbies. We'd love to hear about them. 877-929-9673 or email us words@waywardradio.org.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Madeline from the Manistee National Forest.
Now, where is that?
Well, if you look at the back of your left hand, It's the base of your little fingernail on the shores of Lake Michigan.
What can we do for you today?
Well, I have a question about a word. In the 1930s, we were wearing overalls, denim overalls. In the 1940s, we wore dungarees. 1950s, we wore Levi's. In the 1960s, I wore blue jeans. In the 1970s, I was wearing bell bottoms. Now we have jeans or flares. And the question I have is the word dungarees. I have associated it with either the ocean or the barn, and I didn't know whether that was correct or not.
With the barn?
Yep. The dung part of it.
Oh. wearing those muck out stalls, huh?
Right.
Okay. No, it doesn't have to do with oceans or barns, really. Well, maybe ocean's a little bit, since it has to do with the export of fabric from India. The term dungarees is actually a relic of the British colonial presence in India. And dungaree was the name of a kind of cotton cloth that was exported from India to England in the 1600s. And it came from this place that in the Marathi language, and that's a language of Western India, sounds sort of like Dongari Kila. It means hill fort, and it was this fortification and a port near what is now Mumbai. And this dungaree fabric that was produced there was originally used to make sails and tents, but it was adapted for sturdy work clothes. And so dungarees became the word for trousers made from this material that was produced in that village. And then since the late 16th century, the English were importing another kind of fabric, a cotton twill from another port city, that is the Italian port city of Genoa. And this fabric from Genoa eventually became known as jean or fabric. In the same way that the dungaree fabric was used to make dungarees, trousers made from this fabric eventually called jean from Genoa were called jeans. And goes on. You asked about Levi's. I imagine you know that one.
Yeah, and during the war in the 1940s, I was a 3-year-old running around San Diego, and that's when I first heard dungarees, and we used it for a while, and then the chain changed through the years.
It's interesting, too, because in the UK, the term dungarees now refers to what we in this country call bib overalls.
Yeah, that's right. I was just puzzled because, my dad was in the Navy, and that was why I associated it with the mariners, but that's wrong when it comes to India. So I appreciate finding out. I've been wondering about him for some time. And thank you so much. I sure enjoy your show.
Madeline, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome.
Take care now.
Take care.
There are puzzles in everyday life, whether you're in your body, or your mouth. There's a story behind every word. 877-929-9673. Email words at waywardradio.org.
In the parts of Appalachia, if you want to describe coffee that's really weak, you can describe it as scared water.
I love that.
Scared water.
You mean that scared water?
I like that a whole bunch.
I do too.
877-929-9673. You're listening to A Way With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. If you're reading a book with an index, you probably take that index for granted. But it turns out that indexes and their history are far more interesting than you might think. And their story is told in a delightfully nerdy new book by Dennis Duncan. It's called, appropriately enough, Index: A History of the. And it turns out the history of the index is really about the history of writing and the history of the books themselves. Even in antiquity, Plato worried that the new technology of the time, that is, writing and reading, was going to make people stupid because they'd stop memorizing things and be dependent on the written word. And even in the Middle Ages, as scribes started using indexes, these new contrivances were not entirely welcome, surprisingly enough. Indexes provoke similar concerns. People worried, well, if a book has an index, why would anybody actually read a book? And in the early 18th century, Jonathan Swift worried that people would pretend to understand a book. Quote, by scouting through the index, as if a traveler should go about to describe a palace when he has seen nothing but the privy. And it's also a hearty appreciation of professional indexers. In fact, the author gives a shout out specifically to Paula Klein Bain, who is the professional who wrote the index to this book. And she shows how thorough and even playful a good indexer can be. He also includes a computer generated index. And it's just not as good. It's not as interesting. It's not as alive as the one that Paula Klein Bain produced.
I looked at that computer index and it was fine. I could use it, but it was lifeless. It didn't have the extra knowledge, the pragmatics that a human would bring to the job, understanding that A was a part of B and that you should include it as a, you know, a sub-index item. And computerized stuff just isn't quite there yet for that. The other thing I was thinking as I browsed this book,
and I didn't read it, nor did I do what is called a Washington read.
You remember what that term is? It's when you take a book, you look for your name in the index, and if you don't find it, you put it back.
Right. There's a famous story about William F. Buckley sending a copy of his latest book to Norman Mailer, and in the index where Norman Mailer's name is listed, Buckley wrote, "Hi." Well, that book again is called Index, A History of Thee, and it's by Dennis Duncan.
I'm looking forward to finishing the book. We'd love to hear about what you're reading. We are so delighted, and our table, there's stacks of books that you send us and the books that you recommend. 877-929-9673. And send your recommendations to us in email, words@waywardradio.org.
Hello, we have a way with words.
Hey, this is Andrew from Lexington, North Carolina.
Hey, Andrew, welcome.
Hi, Andrew, what's up?
So I guess I'm going to jump right into it, but my question would be, growing up, my mom and my grandma would say to me, whenever I wanted something, put it in the microwave or read something, they would always say, just get it, or just put it in the microwave. I just kind of wanted to know where that word came from and how it relates to microwaving something.
Okay. So when would this be? What decade are we talking?
I was born in the late 90s, so I would say, you know, the early 2000s, mostly when I would hear it.
The first place that we have records and print versus spoken, because obviously we can't track what people say, but they write it down, we can match the words to dates, and that first match that we have is from the Daily Tar Heel, which is a student newspaper of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, 1982, of students' long, jokey piece about students nuking food and on the college campus,
talking about melting things in the microwave.
Which is really interesting because obviously nuking things, nuclear weapons, is terrible. You know, this is talking about going from the idea of nuclear bombs to nuclear weapons to microwaving food. It's just a really big leap, right? There is a path there.
And part of it has to do with how we got from the word nuclear to the word nuke.
And it happened almost immediately after the nuclear weapons were used during World War II by the United States on Japan. The idea of nuclear weapons was pervasive throughout the Western world. And by the late 50s, nuke, as a shorthand for weapons themselves, was common in the popular press. And in the military in the 1960s, nuke could be used to mean a nuclear-powered seacraft, a submarine, or a sailor that was assigned to such a ship.
And in the public sphere, nuke was used as a shorthand for a nuclear power station.
So there's this period in the 1960s where you could see a protest where people were chanting no nukes.
And you might not know whether they were talking about no nuclear power stations or no nuclear weapons.
They could be protesting either or both, I guess.
Pretty interesting.
But also at the same time, the verb to nuke was growing. And the obvious use to attack weapons was there.
But even almost immediately it starts to use hyperbolically,
which is a great American way with language where we exaggerate or understate to just a ridiculous level.
And we use it almost immediately to mean punish or destroy or ruin.
There's one quote from the early 1960s talking about getting revenge on a fellow Air Force cadet.
It's called nuking them.
This is called semantic leaching, which is a kind of amelioration where something goes negative, really negative to fairly positive.
Wow, that is really cool.
Yeah. And then it just kept going from there until we get to where you can do nachos and warm them up. The main problem is there's nothing clear about a microwave. It's radio waves in there.
Right. That's what I thought as well. So I didn't see the connection before, but it's starting to make sense now.
Yeah, when the microwave popped up in the mid-1970s, I think it was, even though the name of how the food is cooked is right there. The machine is called by the method. I think it was, maybe still is, mysterious to people. I mean, you can see through the little window the food bubbling, and the food is hot when you take it out, but the device itself is cool, kind of like magic. So I think in people's minds, this mysteriousness of your nuclear power and nuclear weapons and the mysteriousness of microwaves just kind of went hand in hand. They're just a weird, mysterious technology to people.
So amelioration, that's what happened with that one.
Something terrible becomes something mundane.
Yeah, well, now I know. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome, Andrew. Call us again sometime, all right?
All right. I'm good. Have a good day.
Take care.
877-929-9673. We continue to gather more terms from around the world to denote somebody who's stingy, the person who never picks up the check in a restaurant, and Rick from San Antonio sent us two expressions he learned in Brazil. One is mal de vaca, and the other is pão duro. And mal de vaca literally means the hand of a cow. So if you have a cow's hand, you are literally tight-fisted.
Having no fingers to pick things up.
Definitely no opposable thumb. And then pão duro is hard bread. And that's somebody who's so miserly that they hoard their bread, nibbling at it for so long that it just gets rock hard. So hand of the cow and hard bread.
Lovely. 877-929-9673. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, Brendan Martin. How are you doing?
All right. Where are you calling from, Brendan?
I'm calling from Lewis, Delaware.
Lewis, Delaware. Welcome to the show.
So I am a recent graduate of Northern Arizona University. And with this freshly minted degree, I decided to get a job market. So as such, I've been going on a lot of interviews, applying for a lot of positions. And I noticed that a lot of these interviews, they kind of, you know, in the corporate world, they kind of are handled in a similar fashion. So a lot of the same questions, a lot of the same answers, you know, one of which being, you know, they kind of want to gauge the individual's ambition and sort of like their lack of complacency, if you will. So one of the questions that they always ask is, you know, where do you see yourself in a few years? Or, you know, tell us about something that motivates you. To which, you know, I usually respond something like, you know, I'm very concerned with career trajectory or, you know, upward mobility. Or a phrase I've been using was a path to ascension. So for each of these interviews, I usually prepare a little script, kind of like a dossier that I can reference while I'm on the phone. So I was writing down path to ascension the other day. And, you know, I spelled it correctly, or so I thought. And it occurred to me that ascension was spelled differently than it sounded. To me, you know, I was like, why is it not T-I-O-N and why is it spelled S-I-O-N? And I thought to myself, who better than to answer such a question than my friends from the West Coast?
So by path to ascension, you mean advancing your career by moving up the ladder?
Or advancing to godhood, maybe.
No. Well, you know, while I do aspire to do both at some point, right now I'm more or less focused on my career, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, the reason that Grant and I are scratching our heads a little bit is that when the word ascension came into English, it specifically referred to the ascension of Christ, you know, the story of Christ going up from earth into heaven on the 40th day after the resurrection. And the reason that it has that S is that it comes from Latin ascensionem, which means a going up. It's related to words like ascend. And it first appears, as I said, in English in the 14th century, and it was borrowed into English directly from Latin in that religious sense. And so today you'll still hear people talking about the ascension of Christ, or maybe if they're talking about royalty, an earthly monarch, they might talk about that person's ascension to the throne. But I'm not sure it's used so much in a career sense.
And it sounded like you were also interested in not just the appropriateness for a job hunt, but also why S-I-O-N versus T-I-O-N at the end.
Yeah, no, that was the initial, I wouldn't say concern, but that was the initial thing that piqued my interest.
Well, yeah, as I said, it was borrowed directly into English from the Latin, ascensionem. More often today, the word that replaces it is the word ascent. And you may wonder why the word ascent has that T in it rather than an S, and that's because it showed up in the 1600s, and it was formed by analogy with another word that had already been floating around for 300 years, which was descent. And the reason that that word has the T is that it didn't come directly from Latin into English. It passed through Old French, where descent meant your genealogical lineage, you know, what you descended from. So that's why those have those T's. But in terms of ascension rather than ascension, that's because it was borrowed whole from the Latin word that did have an S in it.
Gotcha. So descent is just a little more well-traveled in its past to current usage.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. We don't want that for your career, for sure.
Oh, well, you know, I appreciate that.
Advancement might be the better word there.
It will be. Okay, cool. Advancement. Yeah. So this is going in the script now. It's going on the dossier. Yeah.
Well, good luck, Brendan, in the new job, and congratulations. That's a big moment in anyone's life.
Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate you taking the time out to take the call. You know, and I've been a longtime listener. You guys are the greatest, and can't wait to hear what else you guys come up with.
Same goes for you too.
Kick butt.
You sound like somebody to watch.
All right. Hey. We'll see.
All right. Bye bye.
Thanks, Brendan.
All right. Thanks, guys. Yep. Alrighty. See ya.
We'd love to hear the language that you're using at your workplace, whether you're new or been there 40 years. What are the little dilemmas that you have about putting something together, or whether it's a presentation for the whole company or just something that you put together for yourself? You have these little questions, and we have answers, and hey, let's talk about it. 877-929-9673 or email words@waywardradio.org.
Hi, you have a way with words.
Hi there, this is Kyla calling you from Maryland.
Hey, Kyla, welcome.
What's up?
I'm actually originally from British Columbia, and my husband is from upstate New York, which I think is relevant for this question. I often will say things like, you know, so-and-so thinks they're all that in a bag of chips, or, you know, he's really not all that in a bag of chips. And my husband has no idea what I'm talking about. So I'm wondering where this comes from, and I'm assuming it's regional, but I'm wondering if you can tell me.
So, yeah, this has been used since the late 80s for sure, and it may go back a little earlier than that. And it's an extension of the older slangy expression, just plain old all that. And this comes from Black American English, and just... Again, like you used it, Kyla, was often used in the negative. You ain't all that, or you're not all that. And that might have been a shortening of all that great. And just really a way to just kind of summarize just the everything that they are not, just from top to bottom, from head to toe, you are not all that you think that you are. And then all that in a bag of chips was just a fun way of extending that. And it really took off in the early 90s, very early 90s. In 1991, there was a Baltimore Sun story about new slang that was widely reprinted. I mean, coast to coast. And after that, the term was just everywhere. I think lots of people picked it up from there. I'm not saying that the average person on the street, but certainly authors and people who are attentive to new language did. And interestingly, I can't find all that and a bag of chips in the lyrics of any hip-hop song before that date, although, you know, the lyrics websites don't have everything. But I did look. But it's kind of like all that in the kitchen sink. It's kind of like throwing everything in there that's conceivable, you know?
Right. Okay. Because I've only ever heard that. And then once I was watching an English show, a British TV show recently, and they said that so-and-so thought he was all that in a plate of Ritz crackers. I thought that was completely amazing.
Yeah, there are other people. People have played around with it. A plate of fries, a plate of chips, a plate of green beans, a plate of biscuits and gravy. They've done a variety of different things. But usually all that in a bag of chips is the more common one. But yeah, it comes from Black American English. And like a lot of terms, left the speech of Black Americans and entered the mainstream through the usual channels of popular culture. And it's a little dated now, just so you know. And it's not that used, but it's out there.
Well, slang has a way of coming back around, too. So maybe,
yeah, who knows?
Maybe much younger people will start saying it, thanks to you, Kylie.
Maybe we're trendsetting right now.
As we speak.
Maybe. Maybe not.
We are all that in a jumbo bag of chips.
All right, thank you so much. That was very helpful.
All right. Take care, Kyla.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. Bye-bye.
Well, if your slang is new or your slang is old, we'd love to talk about it. 877-929-9673.
Our team includes senior producer Stephanie Levine, engineer and editor Tim Felton, production assistant Rachel Elizabeth Weisler, and quiz guy John Chinesky.
We'd love to hear from you no matter where you are in the world. Go to waywardradio.org/contact.
Subscribe to the podcast, hear hundreds of past episodes, and get the newsletter at waywardradio.org.
Whenever you have a language story or question, our toll-free line is open in the U.S. and Canada, 1-877-929-9673. Or send your thoughts to words@waywardradio.org.
Away with Words is an independent production of Wayward, Inc., a nonprofit supported by listeners and organizations who are changing the way the world talks about language.
Special thanks to Michael Breslauer, Josh Eccles, Claire Grotting, Bruce Rogo, Rick Seidenworm, and Betty Willis.
Thanks for listening. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust.
It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
RCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
This is Depose from The Faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Depose from The Faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. FM. Word to your mother.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you the best music.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, elite news media are saying that Biden has to go to Saudi Arabia in July, despite his pledges to make the country a pariah for abuses, including the murder of a Washington Post contributor, because stability? Shaking hands with Mohammed bin Salman makes sense, even in the context of denying Cuba and Venezuela participation in the Americas summit out of purported concerns about their human rights records because gas prices? It's hard to parse corporate media coverage of Biden's Saudi visit because that coverage obscures rather than illuminates what's going on behind the euphemism U.S. interests. We'll talk about the upcoming trip with Raya Jarrar, advocacy director at Dawn, Democracy for the Arab World Now. Also on the show, congressional Republicans criticize small defense increase in Biden's budget blueprint. Red line headline. Biden faces on increased defense spending, read another. It sounds like a media hosting a robust debate on an issue that divides the country, except a real debate would be informed. We'd hear just how much the U.S. spends on military weaponry compared to other countries, and a real debate would be humane. We'd hear discussion of alternatives, other ways of organizing a society besides around the business of killing. That sort of conversation isn't pie in the sky. There's actual legislation right now that could anchor it. We'll talk about the People Over Pentagon Act of 2022 with Lindsay Kushgarian, program director of the National Priorities Project. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at some recent press. Right-wing media are whipping up a dangerous anti-trans frenzy in this country, as evidenced by the rash of anti-trans laws being passed in GOP-controlled states and recent violent attacks on pride and drag queen events. But as Julie Holler writes for Fair.org, liberal media are also culpable for this shift against trans people and their very right to exist. Holler cites a recent example, a June 19th New York Times Magazine cover story called The Battle Over Gender Therapy that muses about whether gender-affirming care for trans kids should be so easy to access. Reporter Emily Bazelon says she interviewed more than two dozen young people and about the same number of parents. But they aren't the story's center. It opens with a cisgender doctor who works with trans youth, who was surprised by pushback to a proposed revision of guidelines on care for trans adolescents, because that pushback came both from opponents of gender-related care and providers and activists within the transgender world. And this is the piece's explicit framing suggestion, to find a reasonable path between extremes. As one quoted medical source puts it, quote, "Either there should be a vending machine for gender hormones, or people who prescribe them to kids should be put in jail," close quote. Making medical professionals the neutral expert center between supposed societal extremes does many things, among them misrepresenting reality. Holler cites trans historian Jules Gill Peterson, who points out that transgender medicine has actually established very narrow eligibility criteria, and that, quote, "the great expense of transition has kept